What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Mental Corner Podcast, the show where I bring on guests from all different backgrounds to talk all the things mental health. I am, of course, your host, Harry Pavin, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Michelle Finneran. Dr. Finneran is an author, a mental health advocate, and a clinical psychotherapist who focuses on the topics of domestic abuse populations and mood disorders. She now uses her experiences and platform to help educate and inform others on her findings in the mental health and domestic abuse fields. Michelle was such a blast to talk to, and I really want to thank her again for coming on and having this super important discussion with me. Now, before we get into the episode today, guys, you know the drill. If you're listening, please like, comment, share, subscribe, give 5 stars if you're on that podcast platform, share with someone who might want to hear this episode. It's a really great one, and I can't wait for you to listen. I'll talk to y'all very soon. Have a great rest of your day. Peace. Are live. Michelle, what's going on? Thanks so much for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you, Harry, for having me. I appreciate it.
So before we get into anything, what got you inspired to get into this line of work that you're in?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. I have a really, really early age, probably in my preteens, actually. And I've always really have been just a very, I like to listen to people. And at a very young age, it's kind of happened where my dad had a very abusive family life. And so he would talk to me about pretty much at too young of an age about the abuse that he endured. So I didn't have the skills or the techniques to help him, obviously, because I was so young. But I just tried to listen and give support and love because he really had no one else to talk to. So it was really me who he came to. And it happened at that early age, probably middle school, preteens, that I began to really understand and like the art of listening, even though it was pretty hard to hear at that time. And then when I got into my undergraduate program, I took a psychology course in high school that I really, really loved. And then I didn't really realize it until I went to undergraduate at Stetson that I took psychology courses undergrad and did really, really well in them. And I really excelled in the sociology and psychology fields. And so I realized when I did my practicum at a crisis intervention center that I knew that this was really where I needed to be.
Awesome. That's awesome. when you were listening to your dad and you were in like middle school and stuff, does your perspective on life kind of change when you're in that position and you're hearing these stories? Like, does it feel almost like an innocence is kind of taken away in a sense?
It was, I know I can't say it for anybody else, but it was for me. Like, I felt like it was too heavy, too much at a very early age. And I think that was a laden kind of emotionality that I had to deal with that I wasn't prepared for. I didn't have the defense mechanisms to kind of deal with that at such a young age. So it did do me a little bit of a hurt and disservice to hear it, but it's not, I can't negate the fact that's probably one of the reasons why I got in the field in the first place, because of that exposure and that experience. And what happened was I had so much love for my father and I wanted to help him so much. He was very descriptive in his storytelling and the experiences that he had, that I happened to experience vicarious trauma. And I experienced that because I saw the abuse. I felt the abuse from him in his own eyes. Does that make sense? So it's called secondary trauma, vicarious trauma. And it's when you hear, and a lot of people in the helping professions, such as nurses, law enforcement, firefighters, mental health professionals, when they are exposed to set trauma, people that have dealt with trauma or dealing with trauma, they can endure their trauma from that.
So it's like a really intense case of like putting yourself in their shoes.
Very, very much. Too much. And in the field, what I've had to learn to do in order to protect myself is still, of course, have empathy and compassion for those that are coming to you, but not, obviously, you can't enthrall yourself emotionally, personally into a client's life, because then you're not going to have a life of your own as a therapist.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. So kind of moving on a little bit, what inspired you to, because I started reading the book that you sent, like what inspired you to write this book and publish it?
What really inspired me is back in early 2000s, I started working for a local jail. And what I began to realize that I was working with inmate female incarcerated women. And I began to realize that when I started talking to them and they started to open up to me and get familiar with me, I began to realize that these incarcerated women were actually victims of domestic violence. And it kind of like threw me off, actually. I didn't really know what to make of it, but I knew that this didn't sit right with me at all. So during that time, I was in my PhD program and I had lengthy conversations with my dissertation chair at Nova Southeastern University and explained to her that, you know, this is a problem that I'm seeing and I want to know more about it. And she encouraged me to do some research and some literature review on people that provide supports informally and informally to victims or survivors of domestic abuse. And so what I encountered was at that time, the reason why I wrote the book is because I was enthralled in a flawed system that I really, really was not aware of until you're not really aware of it until you're in it, the system is very much flawed. So I wanted to really dedicate my time and my energy to this project and really interview survivors of domestic abuse who have partaked in formal and informal supports to abolish their domestic abuse relationships.
Incredible. Yeah, it's, and I think we mentioned this in the pre-call, it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse. Like these are all things that kind of, I won't say they always get swept under the rug, but there's a lot of times, like most topics that I bring up on this show or bring people on to talk about, there's like a dark cloud around it and people are afraid to talk about it and reach out for help. And like just every time you hear it, it's kind of people get uncomfy in that situation when they're talking about it. So like what is the reason that you found with your research that people are afraid to reach out for help? Because I think there's like the ignorant people or the critics when these things come out, like that there's abusive relationships. The number one critical question that I always hear from people who just don't get it is like, why didn't you leave? Right. Or why didn't you tell people about it? Because when you're from the outside looking in, that's like the easiest, it's easier said than done, but it just seems so simple. So why do people not reach out or try to get that support when they're in it?
That's a very good question. And that's the first section of the book talks about the barriers for victims and survivors to seek help. And one of the things, there's a couple of reasons why, is number one, not to discount victims or survivors at all. But when you're in it, when you're in the dysfunction and you're in the abuse, it's hard to recognize that you're actually in it. You don't really realize it until it can become a life-threatening situation. So it's recognizing that, okay, something doesn't feel right here. I can't really identify what it is, but something doesn't feel right. And I'm going to do my own kind of preliminary research on it. So one is it not really understanding that this is really abuse. And there's different levels of abuse. It's not just physical, sexual or emotional. It's also spiritual, financial. There's different levels of all kinds of different types of abuse. So it just doesn't manifest in one sphere, but those are the three common spheres that we see. And with that being said, a lot of people, because of social media, how they portray domestic abuse in the media, a lot of victims feel that, okay, well, I'm not shedding blood. I'm not getting punched every day. I'm not getting my life threatened every day. That must not be abuse. So a lot of portrayals in social media comes from a life or death situation, which typically doesn't start off that way. Obviously it doesn't start off with a life or death situation. It typically ends that way. Doesn't start off that way. So in that social media has a way of portraying domestic abuse wrongfully, I feel. Mm-hmm. And also victims become very embarrassed and ashamed that this is actually going on for them. you know, the, how, and it could be, it does, there's no type of socioeconomic, gender, you know, cultural type of limitations. It could happen to absolutely anybody. So I just want that to be made very much aware. It does, you don't have to be homeless or, you know, these preconceived notions about what DV really entails and who is involved in it. It can really hit anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, because I know people who have been in abusive relationships, and I think the biggest fear that they had before they got out of it was that, well, there were two reoccurring ones that I saw, because unfortunately I know a couple people who have been in them, but it was, they didn't want to be perceived as like weak, like, oh, you can't self-defend, you can't defend yourself from these attacks, or you have no self-respect for not standing up for yourself. And then there was also, I don't want to give up on the person that I'm with.
In the book, there is, you know, that's a significant syndrome. It's called the Stockholm syndrome, where you feel like you want to protect your abuser. And it's almost like there was one survivor in the book says, well, I look at it like if my partner has cancer, why would I leave my partner if they had cancer? And they compared the abuse that they were experiencing to helping and caretaking for somebody who has a medical condition, and two different things obviously going on there. But that was some of their thoughts, like, why would I give up on my partner? If he or she had cancer, I wouldn't give up on him then. So why would I give up on him now? Is because of this emotional abuse that's going on in the relationship.
Right. So how does, like, because when I was reading the book, this is the one question that kept popping up for me, because like Stockholm syndrome is not, I don't mean this to like lighten the situation or anything, but it just is one of those topics that just completely fascinates me, because when you're from the outside looking in, like we've mentioned, it's really hard to relate to people who experience these situations. So how does Stockholm syndrome like begin? Like, how does that start in a relationship?
Well, it takes time. It's time. It takes time to even engage and promote and foster that relationship. So it's almost like Stockholm syndrome comes from a term based out of Stockholm, Sweden, where robbers robbed a bank and took hostages into account. And so what they did, the hostees and the hostages that took over the captives, were, they formed a relationship. They formed like an intimate relationship. And some of them were like romantic. They became romantic afterwards. But the person that was captive were just so happy that they weren't being tortured or killed, or that they were just so relieved that they weren't being mistreated in a way as a hostage situation would, but they developed the kind of a kinship with each other. And that's why typically the Stockholm syndrome is not paralleled with DV victims. But I did do that because I feel that there's such similarities. Is how victims feel is almost how a victim feels when they go through a Stockholm syndrome situation, where they feel protective and they turn against police officers when the victim call them for help, and then they come out for help and arrest the perpetrator, and then the victim ends up attacking the police officer, that kind of thing. So it's very convoluted, and this is where law enforcement or providers don't understand and don't really grasp the concept of why victims stay the way that they do. It's an emotional attachment bonding that happens that's very, very dysfunctional, but it's still an emotional attachment and an emotional bond.
Right. Yeah. So with law enforcement, like, are they, I don't know if like, you know, the answer to this or not, but like, what's their training like when it comes to stuff like Stockholm syndrome? Because if you just play off the emotional aspect, it's a confusing, strange situation to be in when you're trying to break that up.
It is. I'm not really sure how law enforcement has training. I know that they have training on victimology and victims itself, but I'm not sure about if there's an understanding of the emotional discord that happens between a perpetrator and the victim. And that's why law enforcement is not looked very highly upon with the victim population of DV, because they lack this understanding.
Mm. So is that like a big reason why people don't reach out also when it gets super serious?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of reasons why victims don't reach out to law enforcement. Is a lot of it has, when there's children involved, the children become at risk for losing parental rights, the victim losing parental rights. There's a fear of getting incarcerated with law enforcement, as we've seen. That's the reason why I did the book in the first place, is because I was exposed to a lot of inmates that were victims themselves. So there's lots of legal fears as to why they don't reach out for law enforcement. And just law enforcement don't have, I don't think, the specific training in dealing with the Stockholm syndrome or dealing with the victim population in this sort of dynamic, because they too get very frustrated when they have to come out every single time to the same home, you know?
Right. Yeah. That, and like you mentioned it in the book, where if it's not, because abuse, like you just said, comes in all different facets, when it's not visible on their body, and then you get repeated calls about verbal abuse or emotional abuse, like, it's, how do you even gauge that as the law enforcement?
You can't. That's the thing that law enforcement, they are called to mediate disputes, and they're not really trained to do that. They when they see a physical, tangible marks, is when they are able to make evidential arrests. But they can't really gauge or evaluate if emotional abuse is happening. And that typically what happens is emotional abuse does happen, but then it leads to physical abuse. And that's when the law enforcement officers, I found, can do something about the physical abuse. But in terms of emotional abuse or verbal abuse, there's nothing tangible in a court of law that can prove that.
Right. It's so tricky.
It's very, very tricky, and it's very complicated, and it's confusing for law enforcement officers who do make these calls, and they're very dangerous calls when they do. But it's also very confusing for the victim as well, enduring this, wanting to feel protected, but then feeling what they want to protect their perpetrator kind of thing. It's just a very convoluted, complicated situation.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then, like, law enforcement aside, in terms of like mental health resources for victims who are experiencing this, in your opinion, like, are the resources out there, like, I don't even know how to put this in a intelligent way, are they like legit enough? Like, is it an effective kind of outlet for these victims?
It depends on the type of therapist that they come encounter with. And this is why I wrote what's for therapists in the field, how to become the most effective when dealing with victims of domestic violence. I mean, one of the things that therapists don't do that when I interviewed survivors is, which is not helpful, is that the therapist would not allow the victim to process their story in its entirety. And that's a real big disservice that therapist does for their clientele, because it's probably the first time they're processing the story. And so when the therapist doesn't give that permission to have them elaborate on it, it doesn't serve a purpose, an effective purpose. Typically the therapist, you know, they want to have their own agenda, and they may not, the victim might not be ready to leave their perpetrator yet. So it really, you have to, the therapist has to meet the victim where they're at. Of course, we take safety measures into play. We talk about safety plans, but we also have to meet the client where they're at as well. And sometimes the victim are not ready yet to make that move. And so the therapist cannot push their own type of agenda on them, because that's actually a term called counter-transference. when the therapist wants so badly for the client to take steps that they're not ready to make. Mm.
Right. Yeah. It's just so tricky from the outside looking in on these situations because, I mean, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but it's just like how you're looking at the people experiencing it and you're like, how are you not getting out? But there's like a legitimate emotional barrier that's like impossible to break down.
It is. It's called traumatic emotional bonding. Mm. There's an actual coined term. It's called traumatic emotional bonding. And that's exactly what's happening and why victims have such a hard time leaving their perpetrators, because the perpetrator has facilitated this type of bonding over their victim, consciously or unconsciously. It happens. It's an emotionality, it's an investment, it's an intimacy that is dysfunctional and staples the victim right in the abusive dynamic, actually. Mm-hmm.
Now, when let's say you're just starting in a relationship, because abuse, I'm not a doctor or anything, but this is just my take on it. Like, abuse can be immediate, but I feel like a lot of the abuse that we're talking about and the victims that we're mentioning, like, it's a long-term kind of buildup over time where the abuser has, like, managed to emotionally wrap around the victim. So if you're starting in a relationship, what would be the telltale signs for them to realize maybe, oh, that's kind of a red flag and this could grow into something potentially dangerous for me in the long run?
Yeah, there are a couple immediate red flags that should go off. One is if the perpetrator is really in the crux of, or the relationship, the person in the relationship wants to speed things up very fastly, like prior to getting to know, like having the person move in, talking about marriage, saying I love you really, really quickly, too quick. That's a huge red flag. That's a huge red flag. They want fast movements in relationships. Real problematic. The anger issues, any type of anger issues, you've got to really be careful of. And this doesn't necessarily have to do with anger toward the person in the relationship. This is, could be like a short fuse with like service providers or waitresses or waiters or anything that's, you feel like temperament is high, you know. I think it doesn't necessarily have to be directed to you, but just in general, it's observation that when you go out, your partner is always upset, or excuse my language, pissed at whatever is going on or the person who's helping them. So that's a huge problem from outside the scope of your relationship to really notate. I would say those two things probably are the biggest time tell signs that things are probably not healthy. Mm-hmm. And I think are going to end up healthy.
Right. Yeah. I think it's important for listeners also to note that, like, well, I mean, you know, the friends that I knew that have been in that situation, when, because those red flags did occur, and it was kind of like a side comment that everyone else noticed, and we're kind of like, They've got a bit of a short fuse, and it was almost brushed to the side as like, oh, they're just having a bad day, or like, oh, well, and then like a justification of why they had just the short fuse towards whatever, the waitress or the grocery clerk or whoever. So
right.
Yeah, it's a challenging one, because when you're in that situation and it's moving quickly, sometimes you're like, oh, this is, I've got a good thing going, and you're just trying to find an answer to, like,
right,
or a justification to whatever is going on.
Right. And when you're in it and it's moving quickly, Harry, person doesn't really realize it when you're in it. It's until afterwards you know, when you break up with somebody, you're like, why would I ever date that person, you know, after the fact, you know? But it's when you're in it that you don't realize what's happening, really. And it's not to say that people that are in relationships are not intelligent or they're not smart enough. It's just, it's difficult, challenging when you're entwined in the relationship to actually see the relationship for what it really is, until you separate and become reflective of the relationship. So I don't want to like downplay victims, you know, mindset when they are in an abusive relationship, but it's very hard to know when something is going on that's abusive. And many times the victims that I interviewed, they knew something was wrong. They couldn't really they didn't really know what it really was. They knew something did not sit well. So they knew something was off. So with that being said, and they didn't know exactly what it was. So they did their own type of research, their own type of literature review, or their own type of investigative work on the computer, or go into forums, support groups for DV victims, just to hear stories and see if they were relatable or similar, or, you know, stuff like that. So they knew something was off. They just didn't really identify it quickly as abuse because they might not have known the difference.
Mm. Yeah. It's like their natural instinct kind of kicked in.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, like outside of the victim, like let's say you're a friend or a family member and you kind of notice these things going on, but you're not sure how to approach the situation because it can be a sensitive topic for a lot of people. Like how, if people are listening and they're like, well, wait a minute, like these things that we're like, I'm listening to, that kind of sounds like the relationship that my friend has with her boyfriend or his girlfriend or whatever. How should they approach that?
One of the things that victims talked about, or survivors, I should say, talked about when interviewed, that was very helpful when their friends recommended maybe seeking therapeutic services for their relationship, not going into marriage or couples counseling, but their own individual therapy. And a lot of friends found that they were unable to help in a way that they should have been able to help because they're not trained and they're friends. So they would recommend to their friend who's going through this therapy. And that was pretty much well received through this with the survivors that I interviewed, that when a friend suggested, hey, you know, I hear this, I see this, maybe it's time that you seek some professional help to see what's really going on there. That recommendation really is helpful. So if you have a friend that's going through domestic abuse or going through a toxic relationship of some sort, and you really don't know how to go about helping them because it might be out of the scope of your training or expertise as a friend, recommendation to seek individual counseling is receptive and helpful for the friend that's experiencing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I've had this happen to me as well. If you do that recommendation and your friend is like aware that there's something wrong going on and they like thank you for the recommendation, they say they'll look into it, and then a month passes by and they haven't, and they're still in the relationship, and then you hear the sayings of like, oh, they changed, I talked to them, they're different now, but then like everyone outside of the relationship knows that it hasn't changed very much. Like, how do you approach it then?
Oh, that's a good question. That's what I would do is instead, what I've recommended for informal supports is trying very hard not to get frustrated or think about ghosting their abusive friend, because that's very harmful, because that sense of abandonment comes into play with the victim. So, but their friends also have to understand that they have to be careful with how much they, you know, are on E when they are, when their cup is empty, you know. So it's really engaging for the friend who's helping another friend going through this. They have to also be careful and mindful of boundaries and of that their tank is not constantly on E, and they somehow have to get filled up themselves as a friend helping another friend going through this. So I think it's important to try not to get frustrated or angry or ghost because your friend's not listening to you. But it happens. And if that's the case, maybe taking a step back as a friend and just kind of approaching it in maybe even a different way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's that classic saying, like, how can you can't help people if you can't help yourself first.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I wanted to cover the topic of like abuse in terms of COVID, because we talked about this on the pre-call as well. I mean, you look at the stats and the numbers, like, I mean, I'm not a researcher, but it seems like things are rising. So based on like your research and what you're seeing in the field, like what are the trends right now in terms of abusive relationships, abuse victims? Like, is it increasing, decreasing because of COVID?
It's definitely increasing. It's increasing in COVID because people are on lockdown or are restricted and can't really, they have to stay enclosed with their perpetrator, what makes it very volatile. And, you know, I also have a premonition that there's going to be a lot of marriage and family counseling happening post pandemic because of everybody being isolated in their homes together for long periods of time. And people need outlets, they need socialization, they need other people and family and friends around them. And because we were social distancing for so long, that made it nearly close to impossible to do. So we're going to see a lot of aftermath from the pandemic. We are seeing some spikes in the pandemic, such as high rates of domestic abuse, high rates of substance abuse and dependency, and high rates of suicide. So those are the three trending things that are happening within the pandemic. And, you know, the month of October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And there are resources out there that can help. And I think I sent you a national resource list. If I didn't, let me know and I will send it to you that you can put on the notes on the podcast. But there are definitely a lot of resources that can be used and researched and used to be helpful in trying to either try to wrap your head around what is going on in your household.
Yeah, no, I believe you did. I will definitely put that in the description below for anybody listening. Because we're nearing the end of the lockdowns and the pandemic. Well, fingers crossed. I don't want to jinx myself, knock on wood. I said that 2 lockdowns ago. But how do we get these numbers down now? Because the trends are increasing. The aftermath is, we're about to feel the aftermath. How do we kind of reduce the numbers and then eventually kind of slowly get to a point where they're as minimal as possible?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with just getting like podcasts like yourselves, books like the one I put out, the education and the promotion of education and awareness. Number one, before we can do anything, we have to have recognition and awareness that something is wrong and going on. So podcasts like what you have going on in terms of your education, in terms of the mental health field and DV in this episode, and just like having the victim do their own, and they do their own research as to what is actually going on. And there's a lot more now that the pandemic has happened. There's a lot more podcasts and free TV that can take place where people can and have the ability to get educated, which is great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, the beauty of the internet is that it's so easily accessible and there's so many resources out there to just get.
Yes. And it's just a matter of doing research upon research to find out the right resources for you and in your time of need.
Mm-hmm. Now on the topic of lack of awareness, the other thing that I wanted to talk about was abuse, but the other way, because what we like, I mean, me personally, I do this too. When you hear like a victim or a survivor of an abusive relationship, you immediately resort to, oh, it's a female in that situation. But we're seeing an increase in male abuse as well from their female partners. But, you know, you say that and then the general population kind of goes, that's not a thing. Like, so are these trends increasing in terms of males being victims of abuse now?
Yes, there is. There is a spike now that what happens is typically the victim gets abused and then the victim becomes a perpetrator, and that twisted kind of cycle And now we're seeing offhandedly a lot of increase of men becoming victims themselves. It's a different type of takeaway though from a man versus a woman who is a victim. So it's a different type of takeaway. And that's why people poo-poo it. They poo-poo male victims when they really shouldn't, because it is a serious thing. Women have been increasingly more assertive. They're more aggressive. They have tendencies to be more aggressive in the later part of the year, and they're seeing more. Physical outlets being used on their partner. So it's not an unusual trend. It may have been back in the day, but as of late, it's becoming more and more common that men are becoming victims. But also what also happens is because women are victims, what happens is the tables get turned and the victims then become the perpetrator in the dynamic. And I know that's kind of an odd thing to kind of think about, but it definitely does happen.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a Johnny Depp situation then? I'm not sure if you heard about that.
Yes. Similar, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man. So if you're a man in that situation, like what should be the first steps for you to reach out? Because I mean, how do you even start that process? Because your ego kicks into play where you're like, oh, I don't want people to know that I'm being abused. And then social judgment comes into play. Like where should they start in terms of reaching out?
Like how females do is start out by realizing what it actually is and doing their own, their own individual research on the internet, in support group forums. Start off like that to identify it and recognize it. So doing their own individual work on it, and they don't have to, in these forums, you don't have to participate. You just have to be there and listen. And a lot of these forums, you can hear things that are like, oh my gosh, specifically a man's forum, that are involved in DV. They are recognizably common themes that take place and relatable themes for men. And they're like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what happens to me kind of thing. And it almost like, and it's like, boom, an epiphany kind of goes off. So it's like having them, like I would advise women to do, is having their own kind of preliminary research that they do on their own.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good place to start. I think, there's a couple more questions I have for you, but I think the first one, I wanted to get your opinion on the Gabby Petito case and kind of, because like, it's unfortunate that you see headlines like this all over the news. And I know that one headline such as hers, like with the one that you see, there's millions that you don't. But that being said, I just read an article where it was her dad speaking about how a bunch of people reached out and said, after reading the case, it kind of motivated them to get out of their abusive relationship. Cause like we've been saying, they did the research, realized, oh, this is similar to what I have.
Right.
What do headlines like this kind of, how do I word this? What does it mean for the future in terms of how we're going to go about abuse? Like, I don't know what I'm trying to ask, I guess. I guess what I mean is like, where do we go from here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, I mean, obviously we can't predict human behavior. We can't predict future. It's hard. All we can go by is what has happened in the past. And so in order to be not reactive or responsive and be a little bit more proactive and preventative, I think is the mentality that we need to take. We're in a culture where we're more so reactive than proactive. So I think wrapping our head around trying to be a little bit more proactive, and these headlines spark something within our own relationship and with our own identity and our own dynamics, that we start seeing what we haven't been able to see for ourselves. So it's just about being more preventative And again, this talks about awareness and recognition in which to do so, and then getting the education that you need to be fully informed. So instead of reacting, and until people do this, typically when there's a crisis or when there's a catastrophe, that's when people respond. Well, I think the best way to prevent that from happening is when something is starting and you can feel it, you can sense it, is act on it immediately in order to be preventative and proactive versus reactive. So that's where I'd like to see things kind of go. And this is talking about just any type of systems, systemic issues that we might be seeing, like in the legal system or even in the medical system, whatever the case may be, but all, on a macro level, but also on a micro level, just your own individual, you know, self and system that you might be going through as well. So there's micro and there's macro. And when we talk about macro, we're talking about community and larger groups that can be identified. So starting off individually, micro, and then ending up, you know, affecting, like this one case affected the whole community, you know, as other cases should be able to bring to the forefront and have that recognition and that reconciliation as to what is really going on in that case, and relatable and parallel to their own type of dynamic. So that's important as well.
Mm-hmm. And on the micro level, is there a way that you think would be beneficial or productive in terms of implementing like an education system in the education system, like at schools and stuff, in terms of awareness?
Yeah, there are becoming more and more curriculums, which is, I think, is fantastic, because now mental health, because of the school shootings that have been taking place in the States, there has been more of a awareness that mental health is at the forefront here, and it's no longer swept under the rug. It has to be destigmatized. There has to be an acceptance that we have to deal and work with our own mental health, because if you don't have good mental health, you really don't have anything. So with that being said, academia is implementing curriculum dealing with mental health issues, dating violence, all these different types of curriculums. And I would enforce and reinsure principals and school districts to begin the art of implementation of these curriculums in schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great idea, because I mean, it's one of those things, and you know, on a way lesser extent, kind of like how to do your taxes and do stocks and stuff. But like, there's all these things that schools should implement that just raise such beneficial awareness, like things like that, where you can, like, I can only imagine, like even for my friends that went through it, like if they had just gotten education on it at a younger age, so that when they were dealing with it, they could kind of pinpoint and be like, oh, I know what this is.
Yes. But also not just with that being said, is implementing in school systems. It's parents also need to educate themselves on what their children or teens are going through. So I think that's also important. We can't, obviously our children, we can't leave it to other people's responsibility to educate on these type of topics. So parents also need to do some education and illustration to their children of what is a healthy relationship, what is a toxic relationship, you know, what signs to look for, like we talked about in unhealthy relationships, what to look for. So that education for parents is really important to pass down to their generational kids and children and teens.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it starts with everybody. Absolutely. I think my last question for you, Michelle, if someone's listening, and we've already talked about if you're in the situation where your partner has those beginning red flags of an abusive relationship, but if, let's say you're listening and you kind of just suddenly realized that you're deep into it, like it's been years upon years of subtle hints at abuse here and there, and then it's gotten to a point where you just can't seem to find a way to get out. If you were in a room with the people listening who may be experiencing that and just not knowing what to do, what would you want to tell them?
They have the ability to do. They cannot, they're no longer should be silenced. They no longer should be disempowered. they have the ability to do, and to have that ability to know, to understand that you have even the ability to do and to voice up is probably the first step. And that takes strength, courage, empowerment, and a kind of a fortitude in which that this needs to happen for me, not for my partner, not for my family, not for my relationship, but for me as a person trying to break free of an unhealthy dynamic. That's what I would recommend, is knowing that you have the ability to do.
I love it.
And maybe sometimes, you know, we don't believe in ourselves enough that we should be believing in ourselves well enough to know that. And that's common. That's pretty common.
Right. Like underestimating the power that we hold.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm, I love that. What a way to end it. Michelle, where can my viewers find you and your work?
My work, Surviving Domestic Abuse, Formal and Informal Supports and Services, can be found on Amazon. It also can be found on Rutledge, Taylor & Francis Publishing Company's website. My website is drmichellefinneran.com. I think I sent you all of my contact information. I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Pinterest. If you want to contact me, I have a place in which to be contacted on my website and on my Instagram forum. So please reach out. I can only do therapeutic services in the state of Florida because that's where my license is at. But in terms of collaborations, or in terms of like business collaborations or company organizational collaborations, I can go anywhere.
I love it. I will put those links down below. Thank you so much for coming on, Michelle. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Harry, for having me. I appreciate you.
And to all my listeners, I will see you guys next time.